My name is Paul Hain, and this session is titled, Who Wants a New International Economic Order? The term New International Economic Order is a set of proper nouns. This refers to something specific. For a long time, there's been talk about transforming the international economic order. It goes back, as far as I can trace it, to at least the 15th century, probably before that. But as soon as trading relations among nations became important, people began developing a science of economics. That was the origin of economics. But new international economic order refers specifically to a demand that began surfacing in the 60s and then took the form of a general resolution of the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1974. It's a set of demands made by nations. It's hard to know what to call them. I think the most common term is less developed countries, and I'm going to call them that, LDCs, less developed countries. There's so much hangs on names, you know. If you call them developing countries, that implies something. If you call them undeveloped countries, that implies something. If you call them primitive countries, poor countries, every term you can use is somewhat misleading, but I'm just going to say less developed countries and assume you know what I mean. It may turn out later that I don't know what I mean either. That's one of the problems. But this proposal quickly attracted a great deal of support in certain quarters in the United States among some very small but very vocal groups. I don't know how to describe them exactly. I was talking to somebody about this, and I used the term UN groupies, and they put that. Now, there are people who are very interested in United Nations affairs. They have discussion groups, and they could be counted on if some representative of the United Nations came to your town, you could count on them to organize a group to come out and hear the speaker and so on. In Seattle, these groups focused around the YMCA. And we sponsored in Seattle a large discussion, the Northwest Area Conference on the New International Economic Order. And some people came from the United Nations to speak. They gave speeches. They sounded like speeches. And then there were groups that got off and discussed them. Well, now, what's this, what's it all about? It's very complicated. If you read through the draft proposals and the manifestos and the programs and all of that associated with the new international economic order, you're going to read a lot, and it's not going to be terribly interesting. It reads like United Nations resolutions. In order not to lose the forest for the trees, I'm going to try to describe it very briefly. The demand is for a more just international economic order. Okay. That raises the question, well, what's unjust about the present international economic order? And there are a number of answers that are given. First of all, it's the present international economic order is characterized by a great deal of inequality in average incomes among nations. And many people think that is unjust, and you just cite the statistics. In this country, in Ethiopia, the average per capita income is $40. In the United States, it is $7,000. That is obviously unjust, some people will say. Go on. And then a lot of people said not only that, but the gap is growing. The United Nations resolutions generally insisted that the gap is growing. So not only is there an enormous difference between the wealthy and the poor, but the wealthy are getting wealthier, and some of the poor are even getting poorer. But in any event, the gap is growing. Moreover, according to most of the spokesmen now for the new international economic order, and this is implicit in the United Nations resolution, there are a lot of policies, government policies, that developed countries pursue that prevent development and thereby either cause the poverty or prevent the people of these countries from overcoming their poverty. Those policies include import restrictions. We slap tariffs on imports from less developed countries, making it difficult for them to find markets for their goods. As soon as a less developed country starts producing something that competes with some of our producers, we get nasty about it. Monopolies in the more developed countries, or the developed countries as they're usually called, because now there are three terms. There's more developed countries, and less developed countries. The more developed countries is a term that is coming to be applied to, well, for example, the states in the Near East, and then quite a few others, that some of which I will mention a little bit later. But the argument is that the countries of North America and Europe have got powerful industrial monopolies that manage to charge excessive prices for the goods that they sell to the less developed countries and upon which the less developed countries are extremely dependent. The transnational corporations are, or multinational corporations are, a big problem, according to proponents of the new international economic order. But these companies promote the interests of the home company countries rather than the host countries. A host country is the country in which the transnational corporation is doing business, and the home country is the country where it has its headquarters. And then in addition, there are policies, what you might call negative policies in the developed countries, a failure to do two things, a failure to compensate for past injustices. Someone could say, well, look, you're poor and we're rich, but I didn't do anything to make you poor, therefore I don't really owe you anything. I might make some contribution in charity. But the argument is that the poverty of the less developed countries is generally a product of colonialism and the vestiges of colonialism. And so North America and Europe, the developed countries, owe some compensation to the poor countries, and they haven't been providing it. They began providing it back in the 50s, and then that fizzled out, and on top of that, they attach all kinds of conditions. But then that leads generally to the argument that they just don't grant aid, and aid is due for a variety of reasons. And then I would add one other factor that is very important in the demand for a new international economic order. The less developed countries frequently complain that they do not have an adequate voice on international bodies, economic bodies. Here I'm thinking primarily of the so-called World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. These are two international institutions set up right at the end of World War II. The World Bank, its primary purpose was to corral funds to channel into less developed countries in order to help them overcome problems of capital scarcity. And it's a function that continues to perform. You probably are familiar with the man who for years was the head of it, Robert McNamara. He's been after he left the government, he went to work for the World Bank, and some say tried to shrive his soul or something like that. And the International Monetary Fund was an institution set up really to help nations overcome temporary balance of payments problems. It was not supposed to be a lending bank for purposes of development, but a bank to try to stabilize the international monetary system. And the U.S. has dominated both of those agencies. And after the U.S. comes France and Great Britain and Canada and the countries that put up most of the resources. That's why they came to dominate it. Your voting power in these agencies, a nation's voting power, was proportioned to the amount of its financial contribution. Well, okay, so what's to be done? Well, the basic demand is for assistance, guaranteed assistance, as a matter of justice and not of charity, and without strings and without inquiry. The less developed countries, through the new international economic order, are calling for some kind of system that will assure them of a steady flow of both technological and capital assistance and a variety of other things. I'm just going to run through some of them quickly, which will be a matter of right, not of charity, which will be sort of enshrined in a legal international order so that they can be sure of it, they can count on it. And it's all designed to provide them with resources or allow them to accumulate resources or retain control of resources that will be under their control. The governments of the less developed countries will control these resources. They won't have to get our permission in order to do something. Well, here are some of the things that they want, the less developed countries. They want commodity prices, that is the raw materials that they sell, they produce and sell. They want them to be indexed to the prices of manufactured goods that they buy, and then they want price supports and price stabilization through some kind of international commodity agreements. They kind of want the U.S. farm program. That's what it is. Very similar. That's what we've done for years with farm price supports. We've said farmers ought to get prices that will guarantee them about the same income that they had between 1910 and 1914. And then the government provides a pile of money that buys crops when their prices fall below that and then sells the crops when the price rises above that. And then that way the government both tries to stabilize the prices and support them. Now it's important to distinguish between support and stabilize. You could stabilize prices around a long-term declining or ascending trend. You could let their basic level be determined by forces of supply and demand, but you just try to even out fluctuations, like Joseph was doing in the land of Pharaoh. Joseph was stabilizing, not supporting. And because he did it so adroitly, he made a lot of bucks for Pharaoh and advanced the interests of his family. Another thing they want is less developed country cartels without retaliation. No doubt the big trigger to the new international economic order was the success of OPEC. That was a dramatic event. Here were these, poor countries, 17 Arabs and a camel, and nothing out there on the sands. And all of a sudden, they've got Washington, Paris, London, and Berlin trembling. Well, that gave a tremendous boost to the morale of the less developed countries. And they said that's a great idea, that if we could form cartels, agreements to restrict output in order to keep prices up, and do it without retaliation. That is always stated. They should have the right to do that. And then the developed countries have an obligation not to try to break up the cartel. They thought that would help. They want an okay to impose all kinds of controls, export and import controls, to allow in some imports and not others, to subsidize exports and not others, again, without retaliation by the developed countries. They want debt restructuring and cancellation of debts. Many of the less developed countries are deeply in debt, and for a variety of reasons, many of them are having trouble keeping up the payments on this debt. Some of the debt is to the World Bank. Some of the debt is to private investors. Some of the debt is to governments. And they say the debt burden is excessive. They want it spread out. They want their mortgage refinanced. And they want some of it canceled. And the argument is they make a great deal of debts that they claim were inherited from the colonial period, debts that they really are under no obligation to repay. That turns out not to be a very large part of the debt. They also want the International Monetary Fund turned into something that it was never intended to be. They want the International Monetary Fund to issue money of its own, sort of like our central bank does, and then make that new money available to the less developed countries. Now, the International Monetary Fund does have the right to create a kind of international money of its own. It doesn't circulate, but it can be used in transactions and is used in transactions between banks. These are called special drawing rights, or SDRs, and they really perform the function of money. So the International Monetary Fund got this authority so that it could increase world liquidity if this proved to be necessary in order to overcome some kind of temporary balance of payments problems. But then the idea was the IMF was supposed to destroy these SDRs, reduce liquidity when the problem was overcome, like a central bank is supposed to do in bad times, to sort of increase the stock of money so that people can hold more cash balances. But when things start booming again, you dry up those cash balances to prevent inflation. Well, now the less developed countries are demanding that the IMF create that money for the less developed countries rather than simply to overcome balance of payments problems. They also want the right to nationalize industries without compensation or retaliation. When it is, in their judgment, the right thing to do, they want to be able to reclaim or retain control over their own resources, as they put it. They want technology transfer. There's lots of technology transfer now, but it comes overwhelmingly along with foreign corporations. The foreign corporations bring that technology in, and it's under their control. They want technology transfer without direct investment. They want to know how to do these things. They want the machinery, but they want to control it. So I think you've got the picture. That's what it's all about. Now, the question I want to ask is, maybe seems like a silly question, why do they want it? Well, you say, obviously. If you start thinking about it, it is obvious, but it ain't good. Next question, I'm going to come back to that. Why should we go along with this? You know, these are kind of one-sided demands, aren't they? I mean, they're not saying, if you do this for us, we'll do that for you. They're saying, you do this, even though you don't get anything out of it, except maybe a better conscience. Let me turn to that question first. Why should we do it? Well, some say we should do it to promote our national interest. The argument here is that poor countries create trouble. They start wars, they acquire nuclear weapons and throw them around. It makes for a very unstable world, and we must do something about poverty in the world if we hope to have peace in the world. I'll just note, we can come back to this, that this is a dangerous argument, because I think if the United States government makes the promotion of its national interests the touchstone of aid, the aid is not going to go to the poorest countries. It's going to go to the more developed countries. People do not start revolutions because they're poor. I don't know why they start revolutions. And the poorest countries do not go communist. If our aim is to prevent the spread of communism, I'm not sure that we prevent the spread of communism by giving aid to anybody, but in any event, if the countries which are likely to make trouble for the United States are not the poorest countries in the world. Run it through. And we, in fact, have not given aid that was intended to promote the national interest to the poorest countries in the world. So I think the argument that you fall back on is that we owe it to them. Now, that raises a whole bunch of questions. What does one nation owe to another? Do nations owe anything to nations? There's a problem here, I think, that ethical obligations seem to be things that people have, and the new international economic order will not mean a transfer of assistance from people to people. It's going to be a transfer of assistance really from government to government. Now, the question becomes, why should the United States government put resources in the hands of the governments of Bangladesh, India, and go on down the line, whatever countries you want to talk about? That question, in my judgment, is not easy to answer. What do they do with it when they get it? And some people say, that's none of your business. That's an arrogant question. You don't trust them. This is your, Hayne, you're being a racial chauvinist or something. You think that these people are not bright like you and they're like children. This is paternalism. Well, is it? You know, there's a very interesting thing. In the original draft statement of the UN demand in 74 for a new international economic order, two government leaders are cited as having made speeches strongly in support of it. One of them was the head of the government of Algeria. The other is referred to approvingly by the new international economic order as someone who has his country's interest at heart, who wants aid and assistance and all of that, and he's called His Imperial Majesty the Shahan Shah of Iran. Now, we, in 1974, we were being told to extend aid to the Shah of Iran with no questions asked. That puts it nicely. Some people say, well, we should extend the aid because we despoiled their nation. Well, who despoiled their nation? And what is my responsibility? What is your responsibility for actions of the United Fruit Company, now United Brands, in Guatemala? What blame should we shoulder for this, and what responsibility do we have for making restitution to peoples who were damaged by the actions of United States corporations? I think that's an important question. It's not an easy one. We are linked in, but I'm not sure exactly what the links are. You know, you might ask, well, suppose that a U.S. corporation did good. in these countries. And I might as well confess that I think they did a lot of good in many cases. Do we get some credit for the good we did? If we, you know, if we are responsible for the harm that we allowed, in some sense, U.S. corporations to do, are you responsible, by the way, for the harm that you allowed U.S. corporations to do before you were born? That always bothers me. When you can say, well, but we're the beneficiaries. But what if I'm not the beneficiary? What if the actions of United Fruit simply means I have to pay more for bananas? What if United Fruit was both exploiting the peasants of Guatemala and exploiting the customers and channeling those profits off to fat cats sitting in Poughkeepsie, New York? I think these questions of group responsibility and group obligation get kind of complicated and tricky. And then there's the empirical question, which I will assert is important. Have the relations of the less developed countries with Europe and North America been advantageous to them, on balance, or disadvantageous? The rhetoric of the new international economic order is clear about this. They have been overwhelmingly disadvantageous. I have read a good bit of this. I just finished reading a big volume by the first volume in the UN series on the new international legal order that is supposed to support the new international economic order. And there is not one good thing that I can find in that whole book, it's a pretty long book, said about European or North American investment in these countries. It is all bad. All of the effects have been bad, according to them. Well, I do not believe this is true. I think this is grossly false. The greatest poverty, moreover, is in countries that have been least touched by the West. That's an important thing to notice. The poorest countries are not the countries that the West has invested in, but they're countries that largely have existed independently of the West. The countries most closely linked with European and North American investment have often done very well. I'll mention Hong Kong, South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, Malaysia. And let me mention one other just to shock you. A less developed country, that sun is hitting me. Can you do something about the, is there a? I want to mention a less developed country that in which there was extensive development by North America and European countries that has done spectacularly, Japan. You say, wait a minute, Japan's not a less developed country. It was. It was after World War II. It fit almost every one of the criteria. So what we do is as soon as a country ceases, if a country develops, we say it's no longer a less developed country. And then it passes out of the ranks of the good guys who are deserving and into the ranks of the bad guys who have created the problem. Now that may be. It could be that when you get rich, you start doing mischief in the world. But that's not my point here. My point is that contact with the West, investment by the West, has definitely not been always an obstacle to development. The failure to develop thesis acquires a lot of strength. You know, the claim that less developed countries just haven't developed. They're mired in poverty. They can't get out of it. And it's either our fault for doing something or for not doing what we should have done. That gains much of its attractiveness by this habit of simply taking out of the ranks of the less developed countries those that do develop. So if you include in the less developed countries only those countries that fail to develop, you will prove your thesis. The less developed countries cannot develop. But I think if you were to go back and take the list of countries that was being used, they were called underdeveloped countries back in, say, 1950. Take the standard lists of those countries and then look at them, you'll find that a whole bunch of them have developed rather well. In fact, from 1960 to the present, there's a large number of them that have had growth rates in excess of the growth rates of the United States or almost any country in the...
those countries?
Let's see. Brazil... I mentioned a bunch of them. Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, Malaysia, Japan, Brazil, Chile.
Algeria's one of them.
Algeria, yeah, Algeria's one of them. There are a bunch in Africa. Uganda.
Kenya,
yeah, that's one of them. I'm groping after something here, and I'm suggesting that we're doing some funny classification here. The new international economic order people tend to do this. They put the U.S. and European countries in a category of imperialists, colonial powers, and then they put Japan in, and the kind of creating categories that are sufficiently shifty to manage to prove the case. But and then all the people that are rich have gotten there by exploiting. Well, now let me turn to some of the rich countries. How did Switzerland, the Scandinavian countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada get rich? Now, they had some contact with the less developed countries, but really very little. And I don't think it's possible at all to sustain the thesis that those countries attained their present prosperity by, you know, siphoning off, suction pumping out the wealth of the less developed countries. The question was,
could you explain a little bit of the dependency theory?
Well, can you hold it? Can you wait until I'm finished, and then we can talk about the dependency theory? Yeah. All right. That's a popular theory. I knew it would come up, so I didn't plan to say anything about it. The question. Yeah, it's a theory that I think by and large is not a very good one. So I didn't want to get into it. I didn't want to set it up and shoot it down. I'll let somebody else set it up. Well, no, I mean, if you don't think that a theory is very good, you're not going to do a good job of explaining it. I'd rather have someone else later. I'm sure someone will. Okay. The question, which bothers many people, is why can't poor countries develop? I think is one of those phony questions, like why have you stopped beating your wife? Poor countries do develop sometimes, and sometimes they don't. Moreover, it seems to me increasingly that the remarkable thing is not why do so many countries not develop. The remarkable thing is why do some countries develop? And why have some countries gotten rich? I don't think you can, I mean, if you play fair and count all the countries, the poor ones and the rich ones, I don't think you can explain it on the basis of that the rich ones have done so at the expense of the poor. They're poor because they came in contact with the rich. They're rich because they came in contact with the poor. There are just too many countries that are exceptions. Too many very undeveloped countries that developed rapidly after World War II while in extensive and intimate contact with the West, and some that didn't. And too many rich countries that just didn't have any significant relations with the so-called third world. The argument of natural resource, that some countries are richly endowed with natural resources and others are not, I just don't think that's going to wash either. I don't find Switzerland, Hong Kong, or Israel richly endowed with resources. And Argentina is very richly endowed, to put one on the other side, that Argentina was a developed country in the 1930s, and it has been going steadily downhill. I frankly think that the principal explanation is institutions. The abilities of the people, it is resources, I'll put it that way, but they're social resources. I am convinced that the principal explanation lies in the abilities of the people, the values of the people, and the institutions of the society. And that when the values, abilities, and institutions are there, a country will experience economic development. That will not necessarily make them happy. I want to add that. I do not want to defend the notion that everybody ought to go through economic development.
Of the sort that economic historians talk about and that an awful lot of economists have been concerned about, especially since World War II, I do not think you can do better than focusing on the abilities of people, the values of people, and the institutions of the society. And among those institutions, I think government is absolutely critical. The governments of a lot of countries have been eager to plan in detail, but unable to govern. It's kind of ironic that people will admit that many of these countries do not have stable, efficient, effective governments, and yet will put upon these governments enormous responsibilities by way of planning detail in their economic system. I find that very strange indeed. The planners in these countries, if you look at what they do in detail, they do not strike me as terribly interested in promoting economic development or expanding people's opportunities. An awful lot of the policies of the planners seem to be much more devoted to establishing control over the economy. Even if I may say so, controlling people's lives. I don't think that's the kind of a government which threatens to confiscate the property of anyone who succeeds in getting rich is a government that almost guarantees that economic development will not occur. A lot of governments in the less developed countries have done that. For instance, very popular in East Africa to confiscate the property and boot out of the country Arabs, Indians, any kind of foreigner. To a surprising extent, in the countries of Southeast Asia, South Asia, East Africa, the people who have made it, started up little stores, and the entrepreneurs have been foreigners. They've been migrants. And they have been the victims of some very cruel persecution. Only some of it is related, I think, to their entrepreneurial success. But I think some of it is related. That is kind of a resentment of the foreigner. The sort of thing that we are well familiar with in our society with respect to Jews. We use their success, mix it with our racial prejudices, and go after them. I believe that with Adam Smith, that the primary task of a government is to establish security of property for its citizens so that they can plan with some confidence that the results of their planning will accrue to them and not arbitrarily to someone else. The evidence that government aid, that aid from one government to another, promotes improved living conditions for poor people is very scarce. That aid, too, does not go down, trickle down to the poorest people in the society. And if you look at the institutions, the government institutions and other institutions of these societies, there's little reason to expect it to. Those societies are not set up for that aid to trickle down. Bangladesh. Maybe some of you have seen the stories recently about aid to Bangladesh. When we give food aid to Bangladesh, that most of that is passed out to middle-class people as rewards to reduce their discontent, because once again, the government of Bangladesh knows, too, that it isn't the poor who start revolutions, it's the middle classes who are unhappy with the loss of status or decline in their relative economic position. This is the way it goes, and it shouldn't surprise us. Those who are able, powerful, adroit, unscrupulous, I'm really not trying to pass a judgment, you're pro or con, but the people who know how to get it are the people who tend to get it. And those who know how to get it already have some of it. And so when aid comes into the government, the people who know the government, who know the ins and the outs, who are affiliated with it, are the people who get most of the aid. I didn't answer my question. Who wants a new international? Oh boy, I'm sorry. I thought I was going to quit 10 minutes. Who wants a new international economic order? I know three groups that want it. A lot of Americans affiliated with the YMCA, a lot of Americans who believe that the U.S. has an obligation to help institute this kind of order for moral reasons. The governments of these countries and a vast United Nations bureaucracy, which is the agency that goes around making speeches for the new international order, publishes the books. A lot of people who work for the United Nations and who would, under this system, find enormous expansion in employment opportunities. I'm serious about that. That has been... You've been looking at me hostily for a long time, so... No. You've been looking at me suspiciously. Go ahead.
What a breath of fresh air. What a breath of fresh air.
Now, the young, I don't know your name, behind you, sir. What, huh? Kathy. You want to say something, because it's important now, about the dependency theory?
I just thought that you were sort of dismissing it before you explained what it was, and I thought that it would be important to explain what the theory is so that people would then know what it is.
Well, I did sort of explain it when I said it was the claim that the poverty of third world countries was a result of investment by American, North American, and European countries. Now, you want me to run through how that's supposed to work? Or?
I don't know.
Well, the basic argument is that there are a whole bunch of arguments. I think the basic one, the one that is most popular in those countries where that theory is most popular, theory is that the foreign transnational corporations and other North American U.S. interests, colonial imperialist interests, have come into those countries, glommed onto most of the resources with the aid and connivance of the elites of those countries. And they've struck these unholy bargains. And indeed, there are people in these countries, Venezuela, for example, which is a good example. I mean, if you want to come up with a good empirical case to support the tendencia theory, Venezuela would be one of the best ones to take. And the result is that we create two economies there, a small enclave of people indeed who have developed, who've gotten wealthy, and who are Western, take their vacations in Switzerland. But the resources of the country then are pulled away from the really poor people. The land of the country, instead of being used to grow food, to feed the people, goes into the production of export crops that are shipped off to North America, and then the gains, they're supposed to be gains from international trade, but when the gains come back, they all go to the rich people. And so that the argument usually runs then, the only way then to get development is to kick out simultaneously the elites of our country, our native elites, and the foreigners. And since they support each other, you got to kick them out at the same time. And that usually leads to the contention that only a socialist revolution will do it. Consequently, a socialist revolution is a precondition for development. Is that a...
I'm not sure that last part also hooks up with my mind, but I'm thinking
of it. No, I have never read a dependencia theorist who didn't say that, or at least pushed. You know, how would you get it out? It seems to me to be perfectly sensible, if indeed. Marilyn, what's your name?
Mine is
Greg. Marilyn?
In April, I was invited to the World Conference, where in time from the Philippines, I remember Jose Bacolod was teaching, and he had lectured at Harvard and Oxford, so I don't think he took some obscure, off-the-wall person from an LDC, a less developed country, who has not studied, I think, global economic systems or what he sees as the current world international conflict. And his description of the way he views the NIDL and the way you have described it, some details and some descriptions match. But I hear a different tone to the entire description. The man was not angry, he was not vindictive, and he was not blaming Americans. He was gracious. He was calm. I expected a little more anger, I think. And some of the details didn't differ, some did, as to what he said the NIDL was claiming, as to what he expressed.
What were some of the differences?
One difference would be the technology transfer. He did not say that the NIDL was asking that transnational corporations be barred from entry into its own LDC.
I didn't mean to say
technology.
That. Okay, I agree with him.
I didn't
mean to say that they'd be barred.
He explained the technology transfer as the fact that now in many less developed countries there will be a facility which makes the one part of an automobile but does not manufacture the whole automobile. So the people never learn the entire technology so that they can become auto producers. And what they were asking for was complete technology transfer so that not even barring multinational, transnational from investment, but just making it possible that competition could arise within their own culture.
Okay, I agree with that, and I didn't mean to say anything counter to that. I just said they want control of the technology. I didn't explain why they want it, but they clearly don't believe that the present way technology comes in benefits. Okay.
Well, we use some terms, but he would not use the term cartel, but we spoke of OPEC. I think we have kind of pejorative definition of cartel, which sounds like that they're out to manipulate us. I think he was...
To me, it's a technical
maybe
term.
Maybe
not
Vegas
okay.
comes out of my technical. Basically, what he perceived as the NIDO as being was an incomplete, an imperfect proposal, yes. He mostly saw it as a moral cry of despair from the third world, fourth world, fifth world, the less developed countries, that they see a rising difference between the industrialized democratic nations and the less developed countries. And to quote him, within the next 10 years, there's an increasing danger of international class war of the rich and poor if the industrialized West does not respond to the situation of the less developed countries. And I quote again, the affluent of the world must help a dying country. He was not advocating revolution. He simply feels it in his own country. And I feel like much of what you said simply dismissed or lightly set aside the real and legitimate dilemma of these people whom I don't think we can evaluate how effective a transnational has been in their country, how helpful, how much they have been, their presence has been an advantage or disadvantage. I do think that we need to at least listen to them and to get their perspective rather than listening to our own voices about what we think the current international economic order does to them. And the growth model, I have to question whether Brazil, and I really question whether Brazil has grown, whether Japan can be imitated throughout the LDC. In the 14 years that we were pouring aid, $100 million a year into Taiwan, there's been rare instances where we gave that much concentrated aid to a single country with a certain cultural factors that I agree, you said that was an important factor, cultural values and the institutions already present in a country. I think that we've tended to just look at the LDC and say, well, the growth model of economics is possible in other countries. We've not looked specifically at the unique histories of those people, and I just doubt that that can at all be indicated on both of those.
Let me say, Marilyn, I didn't find anything that you said with which I disagree. I think you are correctly discerning a hostility on my part to the new international economic order. I have, however, read about it. I have read the works of the advocates of it. And I believe that the new international economic order will do more harm than good for the poor of the world. Can you hear
that explanation?
Well, I think what it's going to do is strengthen those bureaucrats and planners, those elites, that in the judgment of the dependencia theorists are the root of the problem.
In
my judgment,
are benefiting from the present order. Why do they want to change it?
They don't really. The new international economic order is a very conservative demand. It is it's just a slight extension and modification of the system that's been running in the world since World War II. It's just pushing it a little more in some other direction. It is really a very conservative set of proposals. It will not threaten the established elites in the less developed countries. If it would, I can't believe that the governments of those countries would push it. I think it is terribly important to recognize that this is a demand on the part of nations, not of revolutionaries out in the bush or peasants. This is the demand of highly Western educated, wealthy development theorists, if you will. That if there is a model, if you reject, and you do reject what's called the standard model of economic development, let me assure you, I reject it too. I don't think it works. I don't think the model under which Brazil was developed is a very good one for countries to follow. Well, Brazil is a peculiar. This is more of the same. I really believe this is more of the same. It's just coming with a different rhetoric. And that's why I titled this, Who Wants the New International Economic Order? And it seems to me it's the people who are benefiting from the present system. They are the ones like this. Well, I want to shift now. Let's let other people talk. But you know, listening, Marilyn, is not obeying. Listening is listening. And I know a lot of people who have listened very intently. They've obviously read it. They know an awful lot about it. And they say no. And they find all kinds of faults with it. And I think we should be careful saying that you haven't listened because you finally say no good.
Well, but you can read it.
Pardon?
I think one can read and never leave one's own point of view.
That's true. And I'm gonna say something about ideology, the problem of ideology. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you. I served in the Peace Corps in Asia. I worked for AID after the Peace Corps. A large number of my friends are now in the UN, AID, Foreign Service, and so on. Got a strong international connection. You spoke with more clarity on the problems that I see and saw than nearly anybody that I've ever heard talk on this issue, and I'd like to commend you on that. I want to pose a question rather than state a position, and that is that in most developing countries that I've had contact with, 1920-style socialism is the basic ideology. London School of Economics socialism is what most people talk about, you know, it's the rhetoric that they spout, and if you look, in my experience again, at those countries which are truly developed, it's the ones that have rejected that kind of ideology and social planning and desire to control people and economies and systems and so on. Central question that I'd like to pose to you is this. How does one, both as someone interested in international affairs, confront that worldwide ideology without saying, you know, you're a knee-jerk, militarist, capitalist, exploiter, but just confront it on a factual basis that it isn't effective, number one. And the other side of my question is, how does a Christian approach the problem of approaching the less developed countries with sympathy and with a Christian outlook, while at the same time trying to confront socialism, you know, 1920s London School of Economic Socialism, which is not doing the job, either from a social welfare point of view or any other point of view. So it's two questions. You know, one, how does a Christian relate to it? And the other one is just a technologically, how do you relate to it?
Where is the social
London
School of Socialism?
He's referring to the statement often made by people who are both defenders of it and critics of it, that the brand of socialism which informs the thinking of many of the leaders. India is the best example. You can trace it back. They went to school or studied under someone who went to school at the London School of Economics. It was very influential in the
30s.
Well,
I was
wondering where... I'm
going to be able to answer your question further because I don't know. The problem of confronting people with what I think are some facts, I've not been able to resolve this, and this is the presentation in the village that I gave with the most dread and anxiety, because it's very easy to come off as someone who's just anti-communist or just pro-U.S. military might or not concerned about the problem of starving people, and I do not know, and as to what a Christian does, I don't know that either. I can only answer for myself. I don't believe Marilyn knows that there are Christian solutions to these problems. There are Christians who get concerned about and try to
solve these problems and sometimes do a lot of good and sometimes do a lot of damage. I don't know. And it bothers me. It is not, that's what people come back with. They finally say, you know, long discussions, and I pull out all the numbers on growth rates and change the definitions and all that and show all the statistical. There's not a lot of statistical nonsense that floats around in this area. By very good people, Ron Sider, for example, is a person whom never met, but I respect him deeply. And when he, in his book, Rich Christians in a Hungry World, for example, is trying to point out the problems, how the U.S. wealth is secured at the expense of the poor nations, he offers two pieces, interesting pieces of fact. One is that the U.S., that the prices that these countries get for their exports have been declining. Now that's questionable, by the way, but anyway, he claims those prices are too low. Then another place, he compares the exports of food into the United States with exports out, and shows that imports coming in are greater than going out, and he concludes that we're siphoning more food out of these countries than we're sending back to them. Now you can't have it both ways. That's value, not tons. The higher the price we pay them, you know, if we're good on criterion one, and we pay them high prices for their exports, and they're exporting agricultural products like coffee and cocoa and peanuts and stuff like that, the higher the price we pay them, the better we will score on one criterion, but the worse we will score on the other one, because now we're taking in more food than we're sending out. Now that's those sorts of figures. They get into the literature, and because they support the case, they're quoted over and over again. And they're an amazing number of figures like this. And it's very hard to run them down and get at them. It's difficult. Yeah.
I have a question from Maryland, and it's kind of seems to me to be more kind of a basic thing. This new international conference is not a border. Wants technology. Is this the same technology, and when using corporate, is this the same technology that the other night you thought the United States ought to get rid of by returning to an agrarian economic system?
Point about technology transfer, I've heard it differently from two different sources. I'm not necessarily in favor, no, of the kind of technology that they feel they need. And I have to listen to them say that they think they want that, and that they want an economic growth model to some extent, or a different form of development. But I was just trying to say that I've heard two different trains on the same point.
I'm going to get the last word in, Jim. I want to point out that this, the whole issue, ideology influences thinking in this area. It influences mine. It influences yours. It's interesting that we are so much more adept at spotting someone else's ideology than we are in spotting our own. There's the one ideology that says America is rich because we're good. The reason we're rich is because we got out there and hustled way back there and did the things that have to be done, you know, and a kind of theology of glory. But there is another ideology that is another kind of theology of glory that uses the glory as in its willingness to shoulder the cross. And I'm saying this now because I think this is terribly important. There are people who believe that they are righteous because they feel guilty. And I think that is a dangerous and a terrible thing. Feeling guilty doesn't do anybody any good. The question of what the U.S. has done to or for these countries and what it should do to or for them, it seems to me, is primarily an empirical question. And turning it immediately into a moral question guarantees that we won't listen to those who disagree.